Now, well, you've all been waiting for the good news. We have our guest, Michael Link. And Michael is a law professor at University of Western Ontario, and he was a special rapporteur for on human rights in the occupied territories of Palestine. He's also co-author of a very important book on the UN's responsibilities toward the Palestinians. I think he's joined us now. Are you there, Michael?
How are you? I'm glad to be here. Thank you for your patience.
Well, Michael, you know, some time back, I was hoping to talk to you about sort of the background of the situation that was evolving. But I have to say that everyone wants to know, I believe, what your assessment is of this historic moment where South Africa, a former apartheid state, now an independent sovereign country in Africa, 60 million people, they have brought a case, and I'll leave it to you to assess the significance of it. It seems like a historic moment. It has a place, the whole world is buzzing about it. So what is your assessment of what happened at the International Court of Justice?
Sure. This was truly an historic decision that was issued by the International Court of Justice on this past Friday. Let's keep in mind that the International Court of Justice is the highest judicial body in the United Nations system. There are 15 judges who serve for, I think, a variety of between 7 and 9 year terms, and they can repeat it once. They come from all parts of the world. So there are six judges from what we would call the Global North. There are eight judges from what we call the Global South. The judge as well from Russia. The court heard an argument 2 weeks ago from South Africa and from Israel with respect to the application brought by South Africa. There's talk in the background. Sorry, I'm.
It's like a normal phone.
Yeah. Oh, let me. Yes, just let me. I think people didn't realize their voices are picked up on the air. So,
okay.
Have you cleared that? Okay. I'm sorry. Yes, please.
Okay. So, South Africa brought the application with an 84-page application at the very end of December. With a, it was an extraordinarily well-written, well-sourced, well-argued application. And when they appeared before the court, what they were asking for was provisional measures, which is what we would call an injunction in Canada, that would require Israel, on the standard of plausibility, to stop committing acts and intent in its war on Gaza that would amount to genocide. Israel argued the following day, 2 weeks ago, to say that genocide was being committed against it by the Hamas attack of October 7th, and that Israel had conducted its war entirely within the framework of international law. In other words, it was arguing you can commit atrocities without sin. And what the court said on Friday is that it largely accepted the South African narrative as to what's been happening in Gaza over the last 3.5 months. It quoted extensively from UN documents, from UN officials, from heads of important agencies that have been involved in Gaza, including the humanitarian affairs director, the commissioner general of UNRWA, the UN agency that cares for and services Palestinian refugees, including in Gaza, from the WHO, the World Health Organization, and from the very top, from the United Nations Secretary General. Mm-hmm. What the court ordered, the court found that the actions committed by Israel, the extraordinary death toll, including the extraordinary civilian death toll, the method by which it was conducting its operations, the use of starvation and the denial of the necessities of life, the creation of humanitarian catastrophe, its words, the denial of food, fuel, water, medical supplies into Gaza to try to service the extraordinary humanitarian need that was there, that could have plausibly amount to genocide, said the court. And then it turned to the question of genocidal intent, and it quoted statements, dehumanizing statements made towards Palestinians that were issued by the president of Israel, by the minister of defense of Israel, and by the now foreign minister of Israel, and said that the threshold, the plausibility threshold for genocidal intent had also been established by South Africa, and it ordered a series of provisional measures, which basically said, you, Israel, have to take every step possible within your power to stop the commission of acts, which include the killing of Palestinians, stopping the serious bodily and mental harm being inflicted upon Palestinians. You've got to stop deliberately inflicting on the Palestinians in Gaza conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction in whole or in part. You've got to investigate the use of dehumanizing language used by Israel and Israeli political and military leaders. And you have to, and said to Hamas, you have to release all of the hostages, Israeli hostages that you have within your captivity, unconditionally and immediately. Mm-hmm. All that taken together was an extraordinary victory for what South Africa had been asking for. I do want to point out that the court did not issue a ceasefire order. You can look at this from two different sides. Number one, from the South African side, South Africa argued, I think quite correctly, that there's no way that Israel could comply with the provisional orders that were made, such as the stopping the killing, stopping the bodily and mental harm, stopping, allowing humanitarian aid to get into Gaza to the extent required by the humanitarian needs in the Gaza Strip, without reaching a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. If you look at it the other way, Israel says, you know, whatever else the court said, they didn't issue or require a ceasefire, which means that we're able to continue on the way we will, and we're not going to obey the court order. So I think we have two diametrically different points of view as to what the court actually meant here. And I fear without international action, and particularly movement by the UN Security Council, we are not going to see an end to this war, and we're not going to see even a significant scale back by Israel in its conduct of the war. We're going to see many more thousands of Palestinians killed, many more hundreds of thousands, indeed millions of Palestinians suffer while this war continues to be conducted.
Mm-hmm. This is Professor Michael Lincoln. Troubling, it seems to me that we've seen the headlines and as you say, diametrically opposed positions. Now my understanding is that the Security Council, the report, this decision goes to the Security Council sort of automatic, doesn't it? And they have to consider this, and while the court can't make a binding decision, the United Nations Security Council could.
Yeah, you're right on this. The decision of the court is legally binding, and the court said that. It is legally binding on all countries, including Israel. But the court doesn't have its own police, it doesn't have its own army, it has no means of enforcing the decision. So that would then go to the Security Council, and as we know, the United States has vetoed three resolutions over the last 3.5 months, where the Security Council was asking for or demanding an immediate ceasefire to the hostilities. And the most recent resolution that was put to the Security Council was on the 22nd of December, 2023, where the vote was 13 members in favor of a ceasefire resolution, one country abstaining, the United Kingdom, and one country opposing. As we know from the dynamics of the Security Council, five countries, five permanent members, have a veto, including the United States, and that killed that resolution. Now, Algeria is now the Arab representative on the Security Council. It's indicated that it wants to discuss the issue of Israel's conduct of the war when the Security Council meets on Wednesday, I believe, is when this is going to take place. I wouldn't be surprised if either on Wednesday or sometime very soon afterwards, Algeria and other countries bring another resolution referencing the decision of the International Court of Justice, and again requiring an immediate end to the hostilities, a demand for a ceasefire, and for Israel to withdraw its troops and its presence out of the Gaza Strip. Then that presents a interesting dilemma for the United States. Does it go ahead and for a fourth time issue a veto, killing resolution demanding a ceasefire that almost every other member of the Security Council wants and is willing to vote in favor of, and which the General Assembly in early December 2023 had voted in favor of a resolution for calling for a ceasefire by a vote of 153-10.
Mm-hmm.
If the United States decides to veto again, I suspect it will only further stain Israel's reputation in the international community as its legitimacy continues to sink, but it's going to drag along the United States as well. What might happen is that instead of having this fought out of the Security Council, the United States may, realizing that when it puts its finger to the wind, the overwhelming breeze coming from public opinion internationally and diplomatic opinion internationally, mm-hmm. will be to pressure Israel to bring its conduct of the war to an end without having to go through the agony of yet another showdown at the Security Council.
You know, it strikes me, and of course you were a co-author of a book about the responsibilities of the United Nations, the role of the United Nations in resolving these conflicts, that the UN is it's really in a tender, scary place, because if we look at the headlines, actually the situation in the short run is worsening, because on the day of the decision, practically, the United States and other countries, Canada joined in, and UK, the old Five Eyes group, and they actually want to cut funding to the one agency that is saving lives. So, I mean, that's very close to being collective punishment.
You're not the first person in the last couple of days to use the word collective punishment, and I think it's certainly appropriate in these circumstances. Let's review for a minute what UNRWA is. It was formed in 1949, almost 75 years ago, to be able to provide temporary aid in place of the aid that was being delivered by Mennonite groups to the Palestinian refugees who were scattered all around the Middle East, in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and the Gaza Strip in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Today, there are probably between 35,000 and 40,000 employees of UNRWA, which stands for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency in the Near East. It provides a range of educational, health, and social services to the Palestinian refugees. And in Gaza, where the 2.2 million Palestinians living there, probably somewhere in the range of 65 to 75% of that population are registered refugees with UNRWA. UNRWA so delivers aid and education and health to an extraordinary high number of Palestinians in Gaza. It is the main agency delivering the limited amount of humanitarian assistance that's been allowed into Gaza since the war began. Its services are absolutely indispensable from trying to prevent starvation and a famine from spreading even further there. Mm-hmm. It has 13,000 employees in Gaza. And almost as soon as these Israeli allegations that the possibility of 12 employees of UNRWA were involved in the October 7th attacks, mm-hmm. the United States, Canada, and a number of countries in Europe, and as well as Australia, said they were pausing their funding to Gaza. And most of UNRWA's funding comes from the global north. The irony is, on the same day, as you point out, that the ICJ decision comes down saying South Africa has made out a plausible case of genocide against Israel. do these countries then say, well, there's a plausible case of genocide against Israel. Should we cut our diplomatic relations with Israel? Should we revise and withdraw from the trade relationships that we have with Israel? Should we stop our arms shipments with Israel? None of that happened. But instead, they use allegations against 12 employees, 0.1% of the employees employed by UNRWA, to withdraw their absolutely needed funding with respect to this, even though UNRWA had no part in what these employees might have done on October 7th, that as soon as the allegations reached UNRWA about 10 days ago, it took, from as far as we can tell, every reasonable step possible for an organization that's running in an enormous humanitarian operation under extraordinary difficulty, where there is, there's no such thing as zero risk in what you're doing. Yes. You know, if UNRWA hadn't taken appropriate steps to answer this, I could see where there'd be a question of perhaps raising whether or not the funds might be temporarily suspended.
Yeah. No, but they acted on a report. They said, okay, we'll look into that.
Well, they did. They launched an internal investigation. They've appointed an external independent team to do a review of UNRWA's operations in Gaza. The Commissioner General of UNRWA flew to New York to meet personally this last week with the United Nations Secretary General in order to inform him of this, in order to be able to explain what steps UNRWA was going to take. And nonetheless, these nine countries then cut off or temporarily suspended their funding. And all of a sudden, we're into the politics of distraction. No longer over this past weekend are we talking about the impact of the International Court of Justice's decision with respect to Israel. Yes. We're talking about the cutting off of funds and what is UNRWA and why is Israel so mad at it.
Yes. Now, that's what's remarkable is that, as you say, it's a distraction. And I noticed that the UNRWA said, it's odd, we never received any of this until just now.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a report of abuse of a patient by a nurse, you don't close the hospital. You just say, oh, okay, well, we'll look into the activity of that nurse. But the assumption has to be that the UN, it seems to, I have to say, reflect popular opinion in the Netanyahu government that the United Nations is the enemy.
Of course, and Israel does a good job from its point of view of trying to explain Hasbara of what it does and why it's taking these positions. I mean, publicly, it sees the continuation of UNRWA in terms of providing indispensable servicing to the Palestinian refugees in Gaza, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, as keeping alive the idea of a Palestinian right to return. And keep in mind, the United Nations decided 75 years ago last month, in December 1948, to pass a resolution which gave the Palestinian refugees a right of return to their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And that has become, that resolution has been reaffirmed virtually every year since through the history of the United Nations. It is probably one of the, if not the, most reaffirmed resolutions in the history of the General Assembly. But publicly, it will say that UNRWA commits a whole range of sins, minor and major, and must be disbanded. One of the comments made by the foreign minister with respect to UNRWA is that that UNRWA perpetuates the refugee issue, it obstructs peace, and it serves as the civilian arm of Hamas in Gaza. That's like blaming food banks for homelessness and poverty. And he said that UNRWA will play no role in Gaza after the war is done, because it's an Hamas front. This will be an interesting issue, because privately, when you speak particularly with Israeli military and security officials, they will say that UNRWA's role is indispensable. You withdraw UNRWA, you're not getting rid of the question of the right of Palestinians to return, which is embedded in international law. You're actually producing starvation and deprivation for several million Palestinian refugees in the Middle East, including probably in the range of about 2 million that are under Israeli control in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza. They recognize that any damage to UNRWA status and UNRWA's funding brings precarity and security for Israel.
Yeah. By the way, it seems to open the door, too, to the kind of talk we get out of Washington and the UK. They seem to be trying to insinuate themselves into this discussion where they might facilitate a new framework, political framework, where they would basically push the United Nations out and they would run the area now called Gaza.
Well, what I think Israel's ambitions, at least to some members on the of the Knesset and of the Israeli cabinet on the right, the ultra-nationalists, we saw from a conference that that was held yesterday in either Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, where the demand was the expulsion of the Palestinians from Gaza once the war is finished, and the resettlement of Israeli settlements in Gaza. That's the only way, according to these right-wing Israeli cabinet ministers and members of the Knesset, that they're going to wind up having security. Mm-hmm. So it, in effect, plays into what the International Court of Justice was pointing out as a real possibility, that the level of infrastructure, civilian infrastructure destruction in Gaza means that once the war is over, Palestinians in Gaza have no place to return to. And the wordless wish of Israel would be the expulsion or the migration of Palestinians from Gaza, and that becomes someone else's problem.
Yeah, you know, that, I hate to put it so starkly, but aren't we already in a position where we have to ask the question, are the Gazans going to have the right to return? Because northern Gaza is basically happily reported by the Israeli military. They've flattened it. And
it is flattened. You know, somewhere between around 70% of all housing, and this is a figure from several weeks ago, has either been destroyed or badly damaged, according to the World Bank. Mm-hmm. We've seen, I think, all four of the universities in Gaza have been leveled. A number of UNRWA schools and installations have been either completely destroyed or badly damaged. Most of the hospitals are non-operational. Most of the infrastructure with respect to Gaza in terms of sanitation, in terms of water, has been destroyed and badly damaged. You know, the figures are very loose right now, but they're quoting somewhere between $50 to $70 billion mm-hmm. that would have to be raised in order to be able to reconstruct Gaza to have some semblance of what it was before. I know that the difficulties that were faced by the United Nations in trying to raise $5 million after the summer 2014 war, which killed roughly 2,300 Palestinians in Gaza, where there was considerable destruction, but far, far less than what we've seen now.
Yeah. Here we have been living since 48 with this question of the right of return, and now people are in a horrible situation, having to have to ask the old question: do they have the right to return? We're speaking to Michael Link, and we have about 3 minutes left. And it's, by the way, Michael is on X at Michael Link 5. I urge people to go there. Michael, I want to ask a question that was nagging me. I saw the Palestinian representative, a woman, at the Security Council. And the Israeli representative had spoken, and she said, well, you made a mistake just now. You called us the Palestinian Authority. We are a Palestinian state. You don't seem to know that. Now, I was struck by that because I don't think the world knows. I read that the Chinese representative is saying we have to solve this by making Palestine a full member of the United Nations. But are they? What is the status of the? Why are we confused over this term, authority and state?
Very good question. I think the answer is because Palestine, alas, kind of has an in-between status when we think of it globally. Something like is it 139 Members of the United Nations have recognized Palestine as a state. You know, I think in contrast, Israel is recognized by 165. So 139 out of 193 nations is a pretty considerable number there. Its status in the General Assembly is as a non-member observer state. So when you see the
observer
description,
state,
yes, and yeah, a non-member observer state is not a recognized as one of the, it's not one of the 193 members of the United Nations. It has observer status on the same basis that the Holy See or the Vatican winds up having. But it has a large number of members, mainly from the Global South, who recognize its legal status as the state of Palestine. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the only country in the Global North, or certainly the only country in Europe that I'm aware of that recognizes Palestine as a state, is Sweden. So just like everything we've talked about over the last 25 minutes, Phil, with respect to Palestine, really comes to a fissure point, a division between the Global North and the Global South.
Yes.
I mean, the whole idea of South Africa bringing its application to the International Court of Justice against Israel, and it had the support of many Global South countries, is remarkable. The idea of Palestine being recognized as a state in contradistinction to Israel's denial of its existence, or the ability to become a state, is again a fissure point between the Global North and the Global South. The reaction with respect to the cutoff of funding to UNRWA again becomes a fissure point between the Global North and the Global South. I mean, what Global South recognizes, and this was inherent in the arguments made by South Africa, is the legacy of colonialism, even more distinctly, settler colonialism, and, of course, the A word, the issue of apartheid. It's no surprise that South Africa, which is a country notwithstanding its own internal problems, punches far above its weight on the international scene, would bring this application, and particularly with respect to its ability to make the argument on apartheid. And I should add very, very quickly that there is another set of hearings that's coming before the International Court of Justice in mid-February, beginning on the 19th of next month, which is where a question posed by the United Nations General Assembly in 2022 to the International Court of Justice, is the Israeli occupation now illegal? And the argument by Palestine, and supported by many, many countries in the Global South, including particularly Namibia and South Africa, are saying that the occupation has become illegal because, number one, Israel, as an occupying power, has annexed de jure and de facto much of Palestine. Number two, because Israel has been instrumental in denying the Palestinians the right of self-determination. And number three, because Israel is practicing systematic discrimination amounting to apartheid, which is an international crime under the 1973 Apartheid Convention and the 1998 Rome Statute, which created the International Criminal Court. So the legal woes, if you like, of Israel are going to continue, I think, through this year.
Well, we have to end it there. Professor Link, we thank you very much. We're very grateful. It's been very edifying. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much for having me, Phil.
Bye-bye. And Tracks from Abroad is next. This is CIUT, the Taylor Report. See you. And remember, the 19th, we're going to be at 11 o'clock. We'll see you.